Welcome to The Medical Maze. I'm your host, Donellen Ray, and today we're going to talk about primary sclerosing cholangitis, PSC, with our special guest, Molly Reinhardt. But first, let's say hello to my co-host, Phil.
You said it correctly.
Thank you. Correctly. I was practicing, so Phil knew. I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get this out or not.
I was trying to. So this is a very, very special guest. So I've been looking forward to this episode for quite some time.
Yeah, she has a very, very compelling story. So I just think that it's going to just be very profound by the time we get to the end of it. I think there's lots of good information here. So let's say hello to Molly. Molly Reinhardt, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I hope, kudos, I said it right the first time, primary sclerosing cholangitis.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
Great. So I'm going to be saying PSC from now on, but, you know, give me credit. I got it out. So tell us, Molly, a little bit about your story, your history. Kind of start from the beginning with this because you have this condition. So what is this condition?
Sure. So primary sclerosing cholangitis, often referred to as PSC because of the mouthful of a name. It's a rare inflammatory disease that causes hardening and inflammation of the bile ducts inside and outside of the liver. Bile ducts are the thin tubes that go from the liver to your small intestine that delivers a fluid called bile, and that aids in digestion. The main thing that happens is these ducts become blocked. And so then the bile gets stuck in the liver and that causes it to have damage and it becomes cirrhotic, which is basically cell death, and it requires a liver transplant. And the severity of the disease kind of comes from different factors. It's a progressive disease. So sometimes it goes very slowly. Like in my case, I've had it for 20 years. As for other people, sometimes it's like up to 9 years till they need a liver transplant. So just depends on how things are, what things look like on blood work, whether or not you have fluid in your abdomen, things like that.
Wow. Well, forgive me, Molly. You don't look that old. So when you said you've had it for 20 years, how old were you when you were diagnosed?
Yeah, I was diagnosed in 2003 and I was 9 years old.
Oh, and my.
Yeah, I have Crohn's disease as well, and I was being diagnosed with Crohn's at that time. I was very sick. I was not having any symptoms at all for PSC, which is usually how it starts. There are no symptoms or they're very mild, but my liver values on my blood work were very high, which raised a lot of suspicion. And because this oftentimes goes along with either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, which is a similar autoimmune disease, they can confirm it with a liver biopsy, which was what they did. And that's how I got my diagnosis.
Wow. So is this, it's a rare condition, true?
Yes. It affects about 1 in 10,000 people. There's 50,000 people in the United States that have it.
Okay. So you, fortunately, I guess the medical community or the medical staff that you went to was aware and they knew about this disease. So there are tests for it. So,
yeah, Johns Hopkins is where all my doctors are. It's where I've been going all this time. And their hepatology team, their liver specialists, and the GI team, they're all fantastic there.
Okay. So you weren't looking for, you were being treated for something else, and then they found this. So tell me, what were you thinking or your parents thinking, if you have any idea, at that young age? And what does it mean long term? And just what's the prognosis?
Well, I would say it's hard for me to think back to exactly what it meant for me at that age. I know it was probably a lot harder on my parents than it was on me, for sure. The Crohn's was what I understood the most about, because that's what was making me sick. I didn't really understand all the disease process involved with PSC until I got into adulthood, really, because I was pretty much asymptomatic. And I just kind of, you know, would be like, oh, I have Crohn's disease and I have this liver disease. I didn't even realize how rare it was for a long time. You say you have primary sclerosing cholangitis and people just blink at you. They've never heard of it before. So I think that more than anything, it was just, I don't really remember a time where I was healthy. Mm. I first started having symptoms of autoimmune issues when I was six. We actually thought I had arthritis, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, because my first symptom was joint pain. And it turns out that it was all just related to the Crohn's. It's not actually rheumatoid arthritis, but I think they call it enteropathic, where it's just sort of related to something else. So it was more like when you're faced with your own mortality, when you're that young, you kind of just view things a little bit differently, I think, throughout life. And I'd say that's probably how it's affected me the most, especially into my adult life. I'm married. I have a full-time job. I'm a veterinary technician. And so those things are all a part of my life. And I've never let this slow me down or define me in any way. So I try to have a good attitude about it. It's hard sometimes, but I figure you've got to do it one way or another. You either can complain or you can sing while you climb. And so I try to stay as positive as I can.
Oh, wow. What a great, great mental attitude. So with getting this so young, do you know what causes it? Is it genetics? Is there something else? Do you know?
So there's no one really knows what causes PSC. It is suspected that it's a combination of genetics and environmental factors. There is definitely a genetic factor. It can give you a predisposition if someone in your family has it. But even if you have PSC and you have children, they're still not very likely to get it. So there's that. And there seem to be some environmental factors, but nothing can be narrowed down to exactly what those are either. So there's very little known about this disease and very little treatment.
Okay. So you've had this for 20 years. So where are you now in the process of this? I mean, it's, you know, because I know that you said it could eventually cause problems with your liver. Are we there yet? Are you holding it at bay? I understand there's no cure for sure. And is there anything other than treating the symptoms? So that's a few questions all rolled into one. But
So as far as treatments go, there's basically just medications to manage symptoms. And most people probably don't really know what symptoms of liver disease look like. A lot of times you might think of somebody with like a yellow tint to their skin or eyes. That's called jaundice. That's typically the main thing that when you're visibly sick, that looks different and kind of odd about you. But usually your symptoms are things like itching. It's called pruritus. It's just like you get this itching sensation, but there's nothing actually there to cause it. You can have something called portal hypertension, which is something that I've recently developed. And that's when a main vessel called the portal vein, which is one of the major vessels that takes blood from your GI tract through your liver, where it's filtered and then back up to the heart. So when it's compressed, that causes those toxins that are supposed to be filtered through your bloodstream to keep going through your system. And it also makes it difficult for your body to absorb nutrients. So people with PSC, including myself, are often pretty deficient in things like vitamin D, iron. I recently was receiving iron infusions and that helped a lot, kind of made me feel like a person again for a while. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that I've kind of always dealt with, specifically the vitamin deficiencies, I think, more than anything. I get blood work every year. I see my liver specialist every year. There's a special type of MRI that's done there. They use a contrast that watches how everything is emptying throughout your system, to put it kind of in layman's terms. And usually everything is just very slowly progressive. Every year it's been, you know, the two main bile ducts, your common bile duct and your common hepatic duct. If you look at like a diagram of a liver, those are the ones that you'll see first. They're usually a little bit affected. And they'll say, you know, like another millimeter or so of narrowing compared to last year. And that was how it had been up until February of this year. I didn't know that anything had progressed. My last MRI had been May of 2022, so not even quite a year. And there was no cirrhosis at that time, no portal hypertension. I actually thought that I was having back pain. I thought that I had injured my back or something at work. And upper right-sided back pain is common, but it can also radiate underneath your shoulder blade, which is what was happening to me. And it was being also accompanied by nausea that was odd. And then I started getting chills and a little bit of disorientation. And I told my husband one evening, we were out with friends, I was totally fine. And then on our drive home, I started experiencing this. And I'm pretty in tune with my body for the most part. Because I've been dealing with this stuff for so long. And I said, I don't know what it is, but something is very wrong. So we went to the hospital. They, you know, did the standard workup of everything. I told them, hey, I have this, you're going to see elevated liver values. That's normal for me. But after my CT scan, they came over and were like, has anyone talked to you about cirrhosis and a liver transplant? And I was like, what? Because I kind of knew that's eventually what happens with PSC. But the year before, I talked about it with my doctor and we had said, you know, you probably maybe when you're 40, 50, I'm 29. So I wasn't expecting it now. And I was just at my local hospital at that point because I thought I had hurt my back, but I was like, you've got to get a hold of my liver team and we've got to figure out what's going on. So to make a long story short, over the next several weeks, in and out of the hospital, I eventually was able to get myself into Johns Hopkins, where all my doctors are. And they confirmed with, some scopes with more MRIs that things have gotten significantly worse in a pretty short period of time. To which my doctor said is not uncommon with this. Some people are like a pretty steady progression. And then there's other people who have next to no progression at all year to year, very slow. And then all of a sudden it's downhill very quickly. And that's what's happening to me now. Once portal hypertension starts, there's big risk of bleeding, GI bleeds. There's big risks of something called hepatic encephalopathy, which is a condition when the ammonia, primarily ammonia from your bloodstream, is not being filtered appropriately through the liver because of the stricturing. And that going through your bloodstream, getting into your brain tissue actually causes brain dysfunction, which usually comes in the form of like a brain fog. You feel like you're kind of, you know, you stand up too fast and the blood all rushes to your head. That's kind of what it feels like all the time, a little bit of confusion, disorientation. So that's something that I started having a month or so ago that I've been trying to get treatment for as well. So that's kind of to catch up to where we are here now. I am in need of a liver transplant at this point and I am listed.
Wow. Wow. So in less than a year, it went from basically no progressed signs to where you are now.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And they don't know why, of course, what makes it go like that for one person versus another. It does not have anything to do with a lifestyle. When a lot of people think about cirrhosis, they hear that word, they automatically think of alcoholism. And that's not the case at all. Again, I was diagnosed when I was 9 years old. It doesn't have anything to do with a lifestyle. It's not contagious. And that's pretty much all that they know about it, and that it behaves like an autoimmune disease.
Well, when you mentioned about being diagnosed at nine, is that common to be diagnosed so young, or is that, do you know of any other people diagnosed so young?
There are some people that I've met through some support groups on social media and things like that who were diagnosed, but the majority of people, I believe the statistic is between like 30 to 40 years old is the average age of diagnosis. Yeah. And typically I think the average time till transplant is 9 to 10 years, but, I've asked my doctor before if he thinks that, my being diagnosed young has anything to do with how slowly I've progressed. And he said that he's not really sure. There's not enough research or evidence, again, because of how many people have this disease, that show, you know, one way or another why some people are able to have symptoms that young. And it might be because that's when I was diagnosed with the Crohn's. If I hadn't been until later in life and I wasn't needing to get routine blood work, we probably wouldn't know, because I was, you know, not having any symptoms with the PSC at that time.
Wow.
But the only other person I've ever met, I've actually only ever met one other person face to face who has it. And he was actually a med student at Hopkins. I met him last year. I was hospitalized for a short time with a mild Crohn's flare up. And he was kind of took a special interest in my case. And I was giving him, you know, the full long 20-year history of my diseases. And he was like, I also have PSC. And he has ulcerative colitis as well, which is the more common IBD that people have with PSC. And he's a couple years younger than me, and he was diagnosed as a child as well. But I had never actually thought about it before. But I was like, you know what? You're the only other person I've ever met who has PSC. And he was like, yeah, it's incredibly rare. He had only ever met like one or two other people as well. So that kind of gives you an idea. But a lot of people, I think, on the Facebook groups, that there's one group in particular. I think they're called Pretty Sick Chicks on Facebook. It's mostly young women under the age of 30 or 40. But for the most part, most of the people that I've connected with are a decade or so older than me.
Wow. So there's no way to, is there a way to slow down this progression? Or there's obviously not a way to stop it, but is there a way to slow it down at all? Because now you are, although somehow you went, you know, you're 20 years past your diagnosis instead of the 9 or 10 or whatever you were told. So is there any way at this point, you know, you need the liver transplant? Is there any way to slow it down till you get it? Is there anything that you can do?
So there is not. There is the step before cirrhosis is called fibrosis. And that is when the tissues start to change. And that's also not evident right away with PSC. That happens with progression. And I have had some fibrosis over the course of the last couple of years that's been noted. It's not known currently if fibrosis can be reversed. And there's also not a way with, especially with PSC, to know if there's a way to stop it in its tracks either. And then once it progresses to cirrhosis, from what we know right now about that term in general, once you're to that point, there's no going back, which is why once you get to that point, transplant is the only option, especially if you have a condition that it's going to continue to progress and lead to end stage liver failure, which will cause you to die.
Yeah. So here you are at 29 and you've been told you need this liver transplant. Okay. So now what? What does that mean? Where are you in that stage of trying to find this? How do you go about doing that? Because you said you were on the list. So if your condition is that rare, and I'm not sure how they do the list. I know there's a MELD score. I think it's called the MELD score, mm-hmm. where they score you as to how severe you are and where you fall on this list.
Yeah.
Where are you? And are you just starting that process? Did you just get on the list? Are you just starting that process? Where are you?
So I was first listed with Johns Hopkins. You have to get listed through a hospital, and you then go on the UNOS, which is the United Network of Organ Procurement. That's how they keep the list nationwide of who is on the list and who has the priority. So you have to have an evaluation with your GI and liver team at the hospital of your choice. And it's an all-day process pretty much, where you meet with a surgeon, a hepatologist, a social worker, a nutritionist, a whole bunch of people. And then once they do that, a bunch of other testing, they confirm your blood type. they then have a meeting and they discuss your case and say yes or no, you're going on the list. So Johns Hopkins listed me back in the beginning of June. Been the end of May, beginning of June. And then I have gotten a second listing through MedStar Georgetown in Washington, D.C. Hopkins is in Baltimore, Maryland. And I'm listed at that one as well. I'm also waiting on insurance approval to go get listed at a hospital in California. And then there's one in Pittsburgh as well, UPMC, that I'm working on. But what basically that means then, once you're approved and you are listed, what that means is you go on this national waiting list. And the waiting list is for specifically deceased donors. And a deceased donor is someone who dies and their organs are used to give transplants to people who need them. So that's like when you go to the DMV and get your driver's license updated and they ask you whether or not you want to be an organ donor, you hit yes or no. If you hit yes, that means when something, if something happens to you unexpectedly, they can hopefully use your organs. The problem is that you have to die in a very specific way in order for organs, specifically the liver. I'm not very well educated on like the heart and lungs and things like that, but in order for your liver to be able to be usable, you have to die in a specific way, usually something like head trauma that's not affecting your other organs or your whole circulatory system. And you also have to die in or on the way to a hospital because of just the time that the organs without a blood supply. So there's way more people on the organ donor list than there are than the organs that are actually used, which is really sad. And you mentioned as far as eligibility goes for these organs. The scale you mentioned is correct. The MELD score, that stands for Mayo, like the Mayo Clinic, end stage liver disease. So it's a number score that ranges from 6 to 40, and it's based on values on blood work. It changes over time based on what your levels are. My score is currently an 8. I actually have to get blood work on Tuesday this week, so it will probably change again. But it actually went down from my last set of blood work, and that's since a procedure that I had that can help open up the bile ducts temporarily. Usually my values get a little bit better after that for a month or so. And the reason for someone with PSC that is detrimental is because the algorithm that they use is not conducive to people with PSC. People who have more common reasons for cirrhosis, like alcoholism, hepatitis, fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, the more common ones, these scales work really well for them, or people who have like some sort of injury, like some sort of herbal supplement that isn't well regulated and causes them to go into liver failure, which does happen. It's kind of crazy. Scales work great for those people. But for someone with primary sclerosing and cholangitis, it doesn't accurately depict the state of illness in somebody. It doesn't produce the numbers that are needed to be appropriately placed on that transplant list, which is a problem also, like I mentioned, because the number of organs that are actually transplanted, there's 14,000 people approximately in the U.S. on the waiting list. Then there's only about 8,000 transplants performed in a year.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So the demand is literally three times that of the supply of organs. Mm. And a good 20% of people on the waiting list do die every year while still waiting for a transplant. So there is an alternative, and it's something that a lot of people don't know about. I didn't even know until very recently that it was an option for a liver transplant. It's something called a living liver donor. So that's somebody who is willing to donate a portion of their liver to somebody who needs it. And about 55 to 60% of that person's liver is taken. And that's possible because your liver is a super unique organ. It is the only organ in your body that can regenerate itself. So for a donor, after that part of their liver is taken out, that regeneration process begins almost immediately. And their organ returns to its nearly normal size within 6 to 8 weeks.
Wow, so, that's fascinating. And I don't think people do understand that either. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. I always say, like, if you're donating a kidney, that's the one thing that people usually think of when they think of a live donation of an organ. You're not going to get that back. So it doesn't affect you long-term at all. Eventually, once you've fully regenerated, your liver values go back to normal. Your liver function is normal. It doesn't affect you in any way after that is finished. The other thing that's good about living donors is people who receive live donor livers typically live as long as or longer than people who receive a liver from a cadaver. They're usually of a better quality because the screening process is so thorough and they have the time to do so with the person because it's, you know, somebody who is alive. It's not a race against the clock to prevent tissue damage after a person has passed away. It also, of course, reduces the wait time for a transplant, and it frees up an organ for someone else who might not qualify to receive a living donor. There are some conditions that make it so that you couldn't have that kind of a transplant. It schedules the surgery in advance, so both the donor and the recipient can kind of plan ahead, and it allows transplant to happen before the person's very sick, because unfortunately, with PSC, that is what happens most of the time. My liver specialist has told me that the best, if not only option, most of the time is a living donor, because by the time you are producing the numbers on that MELD scale that are going to get you an offer, you're too sick for surgery a lot of times.
Wow.
So people with primary sclerosing cholangitis are at a very big disadvantage in that way. The score is reworked every couple of years, but it's very much not equal to people with my disease. And I would imagine there's probably other rare liver diseases that face that same challenge. I'm just not specifically educated on those.
Yeah.
But it's very much a life-saving alternative and something that we definitely need to educate people about.
Well, what's the rejection rate for liver?
It's very low, actually. I'm not sure off the top of my head what the exact percentage is, but rejection rates for a liver are actually lower in general compared to other organs. But living donation is even less so than a cadaver liver. So it's pretty good odds from what I recall, like from my transplant evaluation.
Wow, there's lots of positive to this. I mean, especially since your donor is, you know, not going to have any long-term complications, and that their liver regenerates itself and is fully functioning within a couple months. I mean, there's lots of positives. You know, the recipient gets a new lease on life. You know, they're not so sick that they, you know, they can't go and get the donation. Phil, I think I have a chart. We have a chart on this where it lists the criteria to be a living liver donor. So, and this is Johns Hopkins criteria, because I think there's, depending upon the transplant facility, and I think you said you'd registered a couple or looked at,
it varies a little bit place to place, but overall this is pretty much the list. The major things are that you have to be between usually the ages of 18 and 60 years of age. You have to be in overall good physical and mental health. You need to have a body mass index of less than 35. There are some hospitals that say less than 32, but Hopkins specifically is 35. You have to have a compatible blood type with the recipient, because of how your liver processes blood. I'm O positive, which is universal, but I can only receive, a liver from someone who also has an O blood type.
We were asking about that. We were talking with each other about that.
Yeah, I actually originally was under the impression that I could receive other types as well because of my type being universal. Mm-hmm. So if I were going to donate an organ to someone, I could give it to anyone, but I can only receive an organ from someone else who is type O.
Okay. No positive or negative, just type O.
Correct. The positive or negative doesn't matter. The other two things that are really important is just being able to understand the risks and being willing and able to carefully follow the instructions before and after donation. And you also have to have a strong support system at home to make sure that your aftercare and recovery goes as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, because this is going to be like, you know, regular surgery or any sort of surgery where you, you know, you need to heal. You might need assistance right after. that you would just, you know, moving up, you know, anything like that, then you might need some additional, but it's not something unique strictly to this liver wound, right?
Right. Exactly. Gotcha. It's just like any sort of major surgery that you would have. And it is, of course, a major abdominal surgery, but that's why they make sure that the donor is very healthy. The transplant team is not going to allow you to be a donor unless they are convinced that you are in very good health. So that's also part of the struggle of finding a living donor is who's in good health these days, right? So even younger people, obviously. So it can be a little bit of a struggle. And I've been on the list, like I said, from June. And originally, back in February, my liver specialist had said he wants me to have a transplant within 1 to 2 years based on how things progress. And he's pretty much now to the point where getting close to 6 months later, where he's like, every time I talk to him, he's like, is anybody applying? He's like, he wants me to get on this as fast as possible because of how quickly things are changing. Mm-hmm. As that portal hypertension that we discussed gets worse, your risk of blood loss during surgery increases. So it's a little bit, I do, you know, obviously I'm still up and moving. I'm still working. I've recently cut back my hours because of the fatigue. They describe it as flu-like exhaustion. And I think that's probably pretty accurate. So there are things that it's majorly impacting my life right now. I pretty much sleep most of the time when I'm not working, just to try to catch up and feel as well rested as possible. So it's something we're really pushing for, my family and I, and trying to find somebody who is able to donate.
Molly, I didn't know about the live living donor. I think the general public doesn't know about that because they think, oh, I need a liver transplant, I have to be deceased.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cause like I said about how the liver regenerates, that's what makes it possible. And it's a relatively newer surgery. I think within the last 3 or 4 decades, probably 20 to 30 years, I'd say they've started doing living donor. So it's a recently discovered therapy, or surgery. And it's just something people don't know about at all, because it's not something that typically you come across. And usually because people who are waiting for liver transplants are getting them within a couple years because of the numbers that they're producing for that scale to get an organ.
Do you have like a personal page where people can, I guess, I don't know, fill out information or a screener or some funnel system to where you can see who's actively interested in helping? Because we want to help any type of way we can. So if there's like a link that directly helps you, we will share that to Kingdom Come. Is there anything personal?
So I have an Instagram account that I started a few months ago specifically for the purpose of trying to advocate for myself to find a liver, as well as just to raise awareness about organ donation in general. It's mollys.match on Instagram. And in my bio on the links section, there are links to both Johns Hopkins and MedStar Georgetown's applications. You click on the link and it takes you right to the thing you fill out. So you can do that. There's also a phone number for Johns Hopkins that you can call that I have listed, even if you just want to inquire about information before you commit to filling out a full application.
Well, let me ask this too. Can they designate that they want it to go to you, or does it you donate and then they have a list of whoever is the worst and they kind of the same thing?
When you're doing it through a hospital like that, there are people called altruistic donors who will sign up that way. They'll say, hey, I'm a healthy person, I just want to help whoever. But for the most part, people are wanting to donate to someone specifically. So when you're filling out that form, it's going to ask you for the full name and birth date, I think, are the main things that you need to know. And if anybody reaches out to me, I can give them all that information from a message, any of that more personal information that you need to have. But that's that's basically the first thing that they ask you is who you want to donate to.
What other avenues have you gone through? You know, I know you're on this podcast, you know, so, you know, we're trying to get the message out there for you as well. But what other avenues besides your Instagram have you tried yet?
So I have a Facebook group as well that I've been able to promote through a couple of things. There's an organization called PSC Partners for a Cure, and they're like probably in the country anyway, the biggest source of information for patients who have PSC, and it's a great way for people to all connect. And so I've been able to get a lot of advice from people that I've met through that on how to help spread the word. These days, social media is very much the best way to do it. What's really unfortunate is at hospitals, the living donor team is completely separate from the recipient's surgery team. So it's a good thing because it means that my team is concerned about me primarily and doesn't have any bias. And the donor's team will have their own team of doctors who know very little about me so that they are able to focus all their attention on them. But what that also means is it's kind of hard to get communication. Like if I want to find out something about a donor, which they can't really tell me anything other than someone is being screened if they are. But they can give me that information. But those teams will sometimes have these advocates for the donors to help them, you know, to really know what they're getting into. And they also are available to me to help me know how to find people. But most of these hospitals aren't really giving people a lot of information on how to spread the word. They're like, find a living donor, go free. That's pretty much it. And that's because their job is to focus on the actual medical aspect of the care. And some hospitals do have like actual like advocacy groups. I know UPMC in Pittsburgh has one. I'm actually waiting to hear from one of their advocates, but they basically recommend social media is the main thing. They told me at UPMC, they recently had someone who was able to get a kidney when the guy went to a hockey game and held up a sign that said he needed a kidney.
Whatever works, whatever works. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and let me, and again, this, I think this is a critical thing for folks too, is that, so if someone does decide to do this and they're going to go through this donor and this surgery, so it's not out of pocket to them.
It's correct. Not. My insurance covers all the medical costs. The only thing that wouldn't be covered would be if they discovered like something was wrong with you that you didn't know about. Any further follow-up treatment for that would be on your insurance. But as far as the general screening, surgery, follow-up, all of that is covered under my insurance. And as far as if somebody is thinking about donating, but they live far away, again, that's kind of why I'm looking into different hospitals around the country, but they are able to, sorry, I lost my thought.
That's okay.
They're able to go locally to go through the evaluation.
They may be able to go locally through the evaluation process, but that's kind of up to each hospital. That's something you would have to ask when you inquire about information, if that's something that you can do through your local hospital. But if not, there are also some organizations that will provide grants for people to help cover costs for things like travel, food, lodging, that kind of thing. So that it's less of a burden on those people and their families. So I know a lot of people who have expressed to me, you know, their interest in becoming a donor have just, you know, honestly said financially to take that kind of time off work, those types of things. We haven't been able to figure out how to make that work for our family, which is completely understandable and completely reasonable. Then that's why it's nice that there are organizations out there to kind of take the brunt of some of those extra costs that are going to be involved with this process.
Wow. See, I think that's good to know. So we're talking that the medical expenses, you know, are covered.
Yeah.
Yes, the donor will have some downtime like they would have with any surgery right after. So I understand about, you know, if you have to get off work, but if you can get the grant, great. And so it's really time, of course, in donating their organ. And they need to be type O. They need to fit some criteria. They can go, I would assume, locally after the surgery, maybe for their aftercare.
Yeah, there's a lot of hospitals. I know Hopkins is one that does that for their patients if they have surgery elsewhere, which if that happens for me, they will be able to do the majority of all of my follow-up care after that initial post-operative period, depending on what another hospital is comfortable with as far as like how long they want to manage the care. But that's going to be a lot longer of a period of time for me than it is for a donor.
Okay, so we are looking at, you know, they're saying that you need to have this now, so before it gets worse to the point that you obviously maybe can't do that.
Yeah.
And that being on the wait list for a deceased or cadaver donor liver is probably not, it's going to be a time factor for you.
Yeah,
that's exactly. It is a time issue there. And yeah, that, you know, waiting for that could mean that you're getting worse, and then you're getting worse to the point that you maybe can't have that.
Yeah. Okay, yes, so, exactly.
Okay. So for any folks out there, if you are willing to consider this and meet the criteria, Phil, if you could maybe put that back up there again, just so, you know, we can go over it again, that you, ages 18 to 60, you have a less than 35 BMI, that you are O, you are an O blood type, and that you don't have any significant other diseases or illnesses that might preclude you from doing this, and that you have that support system, and that you are in a mental place to be able to do this. Please, please, please sign up for Molly and other people like her, so that, you know, you can maybe help out. You're going to, you know, like I said, she said in 6 to 8 weeks, your organ's going to grow back.
Back to normal, yeah.
Yeah, and so you should hopefully be functioning right back to normal. It'll just be that period where you're recovering from the surgery itself.
My school semesters are longer than that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But for Molly, it's the difference between now and the rest of her life. You know, it's a life-changing, you know, altering, you know, procedure for her. She doesn't have this, you know, long-term, because I mean, a lot of times I'll ask for folks with different conditions, okay, so what's your future look like with this? Or how do you see yourself in the future with this? But yours is not looking good. If you don't go and get this donor, you're going to progressively get worse. The damage is going to get worse.
Yeah. Without a new liver, it is dependent on how quickly things get. Obviously, too sick for surgery is still not, you know, as bad as it can get. But after that, once you're at the too sick for surgery point, there's nothing else that can be done for PSC. It's literally the difference between life and death. And it's pretty good prognosis with the new liver. That there is a very low recurrence rate since it's a disease of the bile ducts, but it's pretty low. It's like less than 20%, I believe, is the most accurate statistic right now. So hopefully this will make a really big difference. Other people with PSC or who had PSC and have had transplants have said, you have no idea how sick you are, based on the difference of how you're going to feel afterwards. And I obviously very much look forward to that. I've always been a very active person. My husband and I like to travel. There's a lot of things we like to do, and I don't like to be slowed down. And that's something that has very much been happening of late, of course. And I want to be able to get back to, you know, being myself, doing what I enjoy, being there for my family, and, you know, doing my job, which I feel like, again, like I said, I'm a veterinary technician, and I like to make a difference in the lives of animals and their owners. And those are all things that I can only do if I'm operating at my very best. So I hope that I can do that. And I also will allow me to be able to spread more awareness for rare diseases and for organ donation. I think that it's important for everyone to be aware of the need. There's over 100,000 people in the United States waiting for some sort of organ transplant. So we all should be aware of what's involved with that. It's something you should talk to your friends and family about, your doctors. Regardless of if you're deciding you want to be a living donor for someone or if you want to be an organ donor after you pass away. So there's a lot of educational material out there, just a matter of finding reputable resources and again, talking to your doctor or other people who have been donors. I know there are a couple of people who've reached out that have said that they've donated to someone and that if I know someone who's considering it but has questions, they'd be more than happy to talk with them as well and kind of share their story. So there's a lot of benefits to doing this for me or for anybody. There's not a lot more I can say about that. It's not something that I can ever deserve. There's nothing that I can do to sell someone that this is something that affects your life as a donor as much as it does mine in some capacity. So, it's a gift. It's truly, it would be a gift from somebody and something that my family and I and my friends, we would always be grateful for, of course.
Oh, thank you for that message, Molly. And I can only imagine you don't know a life other than this. If you were diagnosed at 9. So imagine, folks, what this could mean to someone like Molly. If you will just go and just think about it, check into it. Phil, I think we have a link on the chart. Mm-hmm. It's at Johns Hopkins. You can go, and if you will sign up to be a living donor, you can save it. It's Molly or someone like her, you could save their life. If you will just click that link and think about it, and if you meet that criteria and you are... you feel it in your heart and your head, and this is where you want to go, please go ahead and click that link, and then let's help Molly out and help her find her match.
I really appreciate that.
Okay. Wow. So I told you this is going to be a compelling story when I mentioned it to you, Phil, and I Molly, what a dynamo you are. You to get out there and share this message. It's not only just your story, but it could be other people's stories, other PCS patients' stories. Thank you for doing that. And let's find Molly a match.
That's right. I agree. Molly, don't hang up, okay? Because we want to talk to you after the show here. But guys, if you did like this episode, please visit our website at medicalmazepodcast.com. All the shows are there. We have our blogs there for each episode, and we'll definitely put information on how to get a hold of Molly as well. So thank you all for tuning in, guys, and we will catch you later.
Thank you. Bye.